Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 20th. The war in the Middle East is now 166 days old. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. A Wall Street Journal editorial the other day prompted a rare giggle from me. The joke is that President Biden is now working on a two-state solution for the Middle East, except the two states are Nevada and Michigan. Funny, right? But the reality is unsettling. Domestic American politics are undeniably influencing the trajectory of the war in Gaza. We'll continue to do our best to track this dynamic without fear or favor here at the FDD Morning Brief, so continue to tune in. In a few minutes, we're going to have Congressman Richie Torres on the show. He represents the 15th District of New York. He's a member of the House Financial Services Committee and the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. His voice has been one of clarity and even inspiration during this war. But before we hear from the congressman, after dunking on each other for their respective constituencies for several weeks, Biden and Bibi finally had a phone call. Bibi agreed to send National Security Advisor Tsahi Hanegbi and Minister of Strategic Affairs Ron Dermer to Washington. Biden's national security team will work with them to plan out a Rafah operation that would help the Israelis achieve their war aims and to avoid a humanitarian disaster, per the president's request. In other words, rather than leaking damaging headlines about Bibi and trying to unseat him, the president is going to work with the leader of America's closest ally in the Middle East and to help the Israelis win a war they didn't start or want. And rather than exploiting this crisis to play to his base in Israel, the prime minister will work with Israel's closest ally to find a military solution that better protects civilians in Gaza. Here's my question. Was that so hard? Despite the best wishes of Hamas's cheerleaders and neo-isolationists in Congress, our two countries share an occasionally dysfunctional but unbreakable bond. To invoke the title of a book written by my friend Dennis Ross, this relationship is doomed to succeed. But here's the thing. Agreeing on how to destroy Hamas is easy compared to the other challenges that loom. When Gaza is over, we're going to need to grapple with Hezbollah, Iran's nuclear program, and maybe more. Rather than virtue signaling to their publics, our leaders need to roll up their sleeves and solve problems. There's a lot of political noise out there, and it's only getting louder. But I've got news for you. No matter who's in power, our leaders are going to have to block it out. No choice, folks. We've got some serious work to do. Now for your headlines. Headline one. Roee Case from Israel's public broadcaster, Channel 11, reports that Egyptian authorities are letting Hamas officials across the border. Ashraf Al-Qudra, that's the name of the spokesman for the Gaza Ministry of Health. This is, of course, the Hamas entity that exploited all the hospitals in Gaza for military purposes. It's also the agency that has been producing the exaggerated and erroneous casualty count for this war. In other words, Al-Qudra is a Hamas propagandist, and he was somehow allowed to cross over into Egypt via the Rafah crossing. Look, nobody is expecting Cairo to be holier than the Pope or the chief rabbi or maybe the grand imam in this case. But one might expect the Egyptians to block Hamas officials from leaving Gaza during this war. That would be the way to maintain neutrality. My question is this: how many other Hamas officials and fighters have been allowed to leave? Maybe we'll find out. Headline two, the IDF has just created a new unit tasked to finding tunnels in the West Bank. I don't like the sound of this, not one bit. Admittedly, there have not been any significant tunnels discovered in the West Bank until now. And the terrain is rockier in the West Bank, making tunneling that much more difficult. But it's hard to imagine that Hamas hasn't tried to replicate its subterranean achievements in Gaza. Over the course of this war, I've heard isolated reports of tunnels in the West Bank. Also, I've heard about reports of possible tunnel activity coming from Jordan. The new unit seems to suggest that there is enough evidence or enough concern to dig a little deeper, if you'll pardon the pun. And headline three, the IDF arrested a fighter who was released in the first hostage deal between Hamas and Israel. In our business, we call this recidivism. That's when fighters return to the battlefield after being detained. the recidivism rate among Hamas fighters is high, which is why the Israelis have trepidations about the number of prisoners that Hamas is demanding in exchange for the hostages. As of a few days ago, Hamas was demanding the release of 950 prisoners for 40 Israeli hostages. It's unclear where those talks stand right now, but it's a safe bet that the ratio that Hamas is asking for has not changed much. Hamas knows that the Israelis will pay a heavy price to save those languishing in Hamas custody. The families are an important constituency in Israel, and they are undoubtedly running out of patience. As of yesterday, Qatar was said to be, quote, cautiously optimistic, unquote, about a deal, while David Barnea, the head of the Mossad, returned home without much hope. It's hard to believe that these hostages have been held for nearly a half a year now. Really just tough to imagine. Okay, it's now my pleasure to introduce Congressman Richie Torres. He has an amazing story of perseverance, having grown up under challenging socioeconomic conditions. Today, he is widely viewed as a rising star in the Democratic Party. He is a member of the House Financial Services Committee and the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. He has strong opinions about what happened on October 7th last year and what Israel can or should be doing in Gaza. Welcome, Congressman Richie Torres.
It's an honor to be here.
All right, well, let's dive right in. You are a self-declared staunch supporter of Israel, to the dissatisfaction of some in your party and some in the other party, too, by the way. How do you strike that balance, being both a progressive and a pro-Israel Democrat? And how are we to understand the growing trend of anti-Israel positions in the halls of Congress?
Well, keep in mind that pro-Israel progressivism is the historical rule rather than the exception. But there is a growing divide within the Democratic Party between traditional Democrats like myself and Democratic Socialists. And the Democratic Socialists are strategic enough to recognize that the two-party system in America is so deeply entrenched that there's never going to be a viable third party. And so their goal is to take over the Democratic Party from within, impose ideological litmus tests on issues like Israel, and then purge the party of anyone who fails those litmus tests. And so I worry that the Democratic Socialists could be to American politics what Jeremy Corbyn became to the Labour Party in British politics. And the burden falls on pro-Israel Democrats like myself to speak out, stand up, and resist the Jeremy Corbynization of progressive politics in America.
Well, I salute you for that. And I know that there are a good number of those traditional Democrats that are still holding the line, but I can certainly see that it's a battle that's taking place there. And so we appreciate all that you do. Let me ask you just follow up here. Congress has a number of decisions to make in the coming months that will undoubtedly influence this war in Gaza. Questions have been raised about military aid to Israel and whether to condition it. Where do you see this debate going? And do you think the Biden administration will slow or alter weapons deliveries to Israel? I mean, I just saw the news yesterday and this morning, Canada's just done this, and that's pretty close to home. So what's happening right now in Congress and with the White House as it relates to these weapons?
Look, I'm cautiously optimistic that the U.S.-Israel relationship will weather the latest storms. It seems to me what we're largely seeing unfold is a clash of personalities. Prime Minister Netanyahu seems to think that it's in his political interest to pick a fight with President Biden in order to placate the far right of Israeli politics. And President Biden seems to think it's in his interest to pick a fight with Prime Minister Netanyahu to placate the far left of American politics. And so what's largely unfolding is political theater, is performative rather than substantive change. I've seen no fundamental change in the U.S.-Israel relationship, nor have I seen fundamental change in U.S. policy toward Israel. And there's nothing new or unprecedented about a complicated and even damaged relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and a Democratic presidential administration. President Clinton, President Obama, and now President Biden have all had their frustrations with Bibi Netanyahu. So this is a movie that we've seen before. It's more continuity than changed. And so I'm not alarmed just yet, because it's changed at the level of rhetoric rather than actual policy.
Yeah, this is a movie we've seen three times, and I gotta say, I'm getting tired of it personally. But I can't quite turn it off yet.
You're not a fan of trilogies, is that?
No, I guess not. I guess not.
They should have stopped at Godfather 2. So that's-
and that's actually, that is true. Okay, I want to turn to UNRWA for a second. The president zeroed out UNRWA funding in his latest budget request, and the last national security supplemental that passed the Senate barred funding for UNRWA. This is, of course, the UN Relief and Works Agency that has been complicit in essentially Hamas operations in Gaza. They were a partner for Hamas in Gaza since Hamas took over by force in 2007. My question to you is, is it time to finally end UNRWA and to look for alternatives? And how viable is it? Is that a realistic outcome right now? I mean, you hear members of Congress saying this out loud, and you get a sense that momentum is building. But the UN is a kind of an immovable object. So how do we game this out?
Well, UNRWA is systemically anti-Semitic, and we should be clear-eyed about the incestuous relationship between UNRWA and Hamas. As you know, Hamas does not exist to govern Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. It exists to murder Jews in Israel. And Hamas has no interest in governing. It has effectively subcontracted governing to UNRWA, to the international community. It relies on UNRWA to govern Palestinians, to provide public services so that Hamas, which sees governing as a distraction, can solely dedicate itself to the murder of Jews in Israel. And what I find inexplicable is that the international community has agreed to and is effectively subsidizing a social contract whose terms and conditions have been written by Hamas. And my view is enough is enough. We have to stop perpetuating the ideologies and institutions that perpetuate hate, that perpetuate the radicalization that ultimately led to October 7th. You know, hate will never bring peace. It will only bring more war, more violence, more senseless suffering to both Israelis and Palestinians. And it should be possible to provide humanitarian assistance to Palestinians in distress without subsidizing anti-Semitic indoctrination.
I fully agree. I'll just note, by the way, something that you and your fellow members of Congress might take note of is UNRWA has a U.S. office. It's based in Washington. And to me, it really looks more like a lobby organization, a lobby office, than a UN agency. I mean, there's no reason for a UN agency to have it that is dedicated purportedly to providing aid to the Palestinians. There's no reason for them to have an office in Washington. So that may be a place to start, but certainly it's not where it ends. We're going to need to find alternatives. We're going to need to find other agencies that can fulfill some of the functions of UNRWA. I think there are plenty of them out there. The question, I guess, is whether the U.S. is ready to force that. And it certainly seems like we're at a crossroads. The Biden administration, just on another note, seems to have, I mean, we've been watching this at FDD for quite some time. It seems to have slowed the efforts to sanction Iran and the leaders of the regime in recent years. And the focus has instead shifted to Iran's proxies in places like Iraq and Syria and Yemen, and of course, Hezbollah and Lebanon. Has Iran somehow successfully insulated itself against American sanctions pressure? I mean, do you think Congress can, do you think it should reinvigorate sanctions that take aim at Tehran's oil economy?
I'm fully in favor of intensifying sanctions against Iran. You know, Iran is the single most destabilizing force in the Middle East. It's intent on essentially causing a collapse of the Middle Eastern state system in order to achieve regional hegemony. You know, wherever you have a failed state, you have the tentacles of Iran, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, a place like Gaza, to a lesser extent, Iraq. And Iran has been destabilizing the Middle East largely with impunity. And October 7th should have been a wake-up call about the nature of the Iranian threat. I have trouble imagining that Hamas would perpetrate such a complex coordinated attack without the knowledge of Iran. We've seen the Houthis, an Iranian proxy, disrupt up to 12% of global trade. We've seen Hezbollah, the ultimate proxy for Iran, threaten Israel from the north and effectively make the north of Israel uninhabitable. There are thousands of Israelis who have become exiles in their own land. Enough is enough. There needs to be consequences for the destabilizing aggressive behavior of Iran. And Iran is acting with impunity and at great peril to not only Israel's security, but to that of the United States.
Completely agree. And I do think that there is some comeuppance due here for the Iranians. I don't think they've paid nearly the price that they should have paid. And of course, for the 10/7 attack and for this ring of fire that they have activated all around Israel, and including targeting American servicemen. We saw that in Jordan, and we continue to see attacks against ships in the Red Sea manned by American personnel. So obviously, we've got more work to do there. And it's my hope that no matter who inhabits the White House, that we start to step up that pressure. It's overdue. I got one more question for you here this morning, Congressman. The chairman of the House Select Committee on the CCP, Mike Gallagher, a friend of FDD and a previous FDD Morning Brief guest, recently introduced that TikTok bill that everyone's talking about. What is your take on this bill? And specifically, do you think it's going to help deal with that information, that the disinformation campaign, rather, that we've seen since October 7th? What are the atmospherics on the Hill right now? And I'm really curious, for those who are opposed to this bill, what are they saying in response to all of this?
Well, I'm proud not only to be a member of the China Committee, but part of the bipartisan coalition advancing the quote-unquote TikTok bill under the leadership of both Mike Gallagher and Raja Krishnamoorthy. First, set the record straight, it is not a ban on TikTok, right? It's a forced sale of TikTok. The purpose of the legislation is not to target free speech, it's to target hostile foreign ownership. There's a consensus in the intelligence community that ByteDance ownership of TikTok is a prohibitive national security risk. ByteDance is subject to the control of the Chinese Communist Party. It is required by law to collect vast quantities of information about 170 million American users and then report the information to the Chinese government upon request. And that is an unacceptable national security risk. And TikTok is not merely a social media platform, it's the leading news source for the next generation of Americans. And the fact that we have put our leading news source for the most impressionable minds in the hands of our leading foreign adversary, the Chinese Communist Party, is an act of national self-sabotage. That would have been the equivalent of permitting the Soviet Union to own ABC, NBC, and CBS. And no one at the time would have said that a Soviet company has a First Amendment right to control the leading media platforms in the United States. And so the national security risk presented by ByteDance ownership has become too glaring to ignore. On a separate issue, but this is an issue, you know, about social media in general, you know, there's nothing unprecedented about anti-Semitism, which is an ancient hatred. But what is unprecedented is the algorithmic amplification of anti-Semitism on platforms like TikTok, which has taken on a new intensity in a post-October 7th world.
That's actually something that FTD's Center on Cyber and Technology Innovation, we've been looking at the algorithm and doing what we can to expose it. But certainly, I think this explains the urgency of dealing with TikTok now. And I appreciate your support for the bill. I appreciate the strong positions that you've taken throughout this war. And just want to thank you again for coming on the FTD Morning Brief. Congressman Richie Torres.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, here's what FDD has on tap for you today. FDD China program, Craig Singleton has a new piece in USA Today highlighting the congressional debate over that TikTok bill. He highlights the significant role the app plays in advancing China's larger geopolitical ambitions, and he explains divestment from ByteDance is the right thing for U.S. national security. FDD's president, Cliff May, also dedicated his weekly column in the Washington Times to the same topic this week. Both articles are well worth the read. Over at FDD Action, Toby Dershowitz and Max Friedman have a new piece in Real Clear Investigations exploring the ties between South Africa and Iran. They provide a detailed timeline of diplomatic activity between the two states in the aftermath of the October 7th attack, and they call on the Biden administration to confront South Africa's foreign minister about this during her visit to Washington this week. I'll also just note, by the way, that there was a senior Treasury official that is paying a visit right now to South Africa. And we can only hope that they will be talking as well about some of these issues. And finally, FDD's Ivana Stradner and Mark Montgomery snagged some column inches in the Wall Street Journal, highlighting the ways that Moscow is stoking ethnic tensions between Serbia and Kosovo. They warned that while Russia is suffering losses in Ukraine, Putin has much to gain by stirring up trouble in the Western Balkans. They write that Washington should continue to expose and sanction those who undermine security in the region, and they also call on NATO to combat Russian and Serbian propaganda campaigns with improved cybersecurity. That's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Tune in Friday for our 50th episode. It promises to be an exciting one. We will be speaking to the accomplished author, former Knesset member, and former Israeli ambassador to Washington, Michael Oren. It's always nice to connect with old friends. See you Friday, folks. Until then, I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FDD.